Okay, friends, Greg Kokel here. And thank you for being part of our show today. Just a reminder for those of you who know about Rethink of Past Years, we're still doing the same enterprise. It has a new name. It's called Reality now, and our next one's scheduled for September in Orange County, which is when we usually have that. And then I think it's October. If I got this right, yeah, it's October in the Seattle area and then November in Minneapolis. So God willing, those will go through. And you can find out more details about that at realityapologetics.com. And we're not sure what's happening in Birmingham, though. So we're actually in the South. Birmingham was where we were hosting the Southern regional of what we now call Reality, but we're looking for a new church. So if you're in Birmingham, you're Montgomery, you're in Atlanta, you're in Nashville, you're in Memphis, you're in Knoxville, you're somewhere kind of in that broader area, we would love to talk with you about maybe hosting that. But what we're looking for is we're looking for a church that's all in, so to speak. That top down, they understand from the pastor all the way down, they understand what we're trying to do. We have a turnkey operation. Danielle is fabulous. She's done many, 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 many of these, and we know how to do it right. So we'll make it easy for you, but the local church does a lot of the heavy lifting. And so we're looking for a real partnership that will really strengthen your local community and those around. If you have an interest in doing something like that, Danielle, that is DawnielleLe. At str.org is the person to talk to. So drop her a note and then tell her what you have in mind. Now, oh my goodness, I've lost a caller here. And okay, well, I'm going to go directly here to Paul in Costa Rica. And the reason that I want to go to Paul is because even though I had some commentary stuff, Paul is down in Costa Rica, down in gosh, is that Central America? My geography is not that good. And he's been waiting for an hour, so I thought I'd just jump on board. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello, sir.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Yes.
You're so welcome, senor. Con mucho gusto, senor.
Muchas gracias. Greg, there's something happening in our country. We had a progressive government come in a couple of term like 6 years ago,
yeah.
And they've been promoting the same-sex marriage thing, and it's actually coming into law this month, and so I'm just wondering, if you were here in Costa Rica, what would you say to my church who's feeling defeated, or people are feeling, you know, we were trying to fight against this, and or
yeah.
You know, the values,
right.
And so forth. What would you say to a church now?
Well,
having gone in the States a little ahead of us, in a sense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. And because we faced the same thing, 5 years ago or so when we kind of crossed that bridge. Stand to Reason had been speaking to that issue for, I would say, at least 12 years, maybe closer to 15 years before that took place. So we were in play trying to provide thoughtful assessment analysis for our Christian friends long before it became a critical issue, and certainly long before the second shoe dropped, as we say, and the Obergefell decision made same-sex marriage the law of the land. Was this distressing? Yeah. The question I think we need to ask ourselves is, Why are we distressed? Okay, I'm not trying to be smarty pants here. I think it's a fair question, and I have to ask myself as well. Why are we distressed? What ended up happening is the culture made a move that is not good for the culture, and that itself is not good. Where unrighteousness increases, the people suffer. That's a paraphrase of two or three different proverbs in the book of Proverbs. You know, where righteousness reigns, people are happy. Where where unrighteousness reigns, people are going to suffer. And so there may be a sense of sadness for the sake of the country itself. Costa Rica now experiencing this encouragement, public encouragement of something that God considers wrong, and it's going to have ramifications in different ways. In our culture, the ramifications were, though I thought personally at the time things would get easier. That whole broad LGBT crowd issue would finally die down, and we can get back to – we could get to kind of a live and let live attitude, which is what was claimed they wanted from the beginning. Instead, they just doubled down on the gender issues and gender dysphoria, etc., which was instructive for me, caught me totally by surprise. And now that's gone just bonkers, crazy in our culture, loco, you know, in our culture. So it's gotten to such extreme extents that it's influencing all kinds of things and making things a lot more difficult for Christians and for society. In fact, also it's going to be bad, just unhealthy for society when a bad, difficult, emotionally damaging condition is being encouraged. Okay, so there's one way. Why do you feel bad? Well, look at the bad that happens to our country. Okay, I understand that. The other reason that we maybe feel bad is we lost. And what I mean by that is we lost. We worked hard to win, and we didn't win. We lost. And that's a natural feeling. But I think it's not a good reason to feel bad, because whatever it is that we were campaigning for, we got the short stick on, you know. So I suspect there's a mixture of that going on in the church. But I'll tell you the thing that helps me the most when I think of this. And by the way, we are facing some very, very challenging circumstances now, much more challenging than I ever thought we'd end up facing, because of, and I don't want to say it's because of the COVID-19 crisis, because I don't think it's because of the COVID-19 crisis. I think it's because of political decisions that were bad ones that we made that we're suffering more now than we ought to be. And the kind of government control that's being proposed now as a result of what we're facing is really scary. Okay, so I'm facing something personally that's similar. Now it's a discouragement that I face as a Christian and an American citizen in light of all kinds of things that are happening right now, similar in a sense to what we faced 5 years ago and you guys are facing now, where something else was really, you know, went bad for us ideologically and culturally, okay? And what is my attitude then? My attitude is what I have to remind myself, Paul, what I have to remind myself is that that I cannot expect the world to live a Christian way. They never have. Before there was same-sex marriage, I am sure in Costa Rica there was plenty of extramarital sex, right?
Yeah, of course.
Fornication, adultery, premarital sex, I mean, all kinds of stuff going on, and even homosexual sex going on. Now, this is just unsettling for us, but didn't we kind of get used to it? Well, this is kind of normal. So we would meet, well, we might meet a homosexual who is going to get married now and think, oh, man, that really bothers us. But we got friends that are living together. And some of them might even claim to be Christians. And so they're carrying on in that way, and that doesn't seem to rattle us at all. So sometimes these are things that we get used to, and instead of feeling their full moral impact, and what we're feeling with a change like same-sex marriage is that we got some kind of new immorality we haven't grown used to. And I just have to remind myself, hey, this is the way the world works. We don't expect them to live by Christian standards. They're the world, for goodness sake. That's the way it's always going to be. And it's a whole lot better than it was for the first century Christians, who had a lot more at stake and faced a lot of the same kind of moral challenges in the culture we're facing now, but they had a lot more at stake, certainly, than we do. Now, I probably, to be fair to you, Paul, in Costa Rica, I mean, I they have a lot more stake than I have in the United Estados Unidos, you know, in the United States of America. But I don't know what's happening in your country, and it may be much more difficult for Christians there. But in any event, for both of us, for both of our communities and our cultures, it's a whole lot better than it was for the first century Christians. So things could get a lot worse. So I have a verse I just mentioned last hour. Was it last hour? To Frank Turek when I talked with him. It's in 1 Peter. It's the last verse of chapter 4. And what it says there is, it says, let him who suffers according to the will of God. And what Peter has been describing through a lot of his letter is that there's a lot of suffering for Christians that is according to the will of God. It's God ordained. God has allowed this. Why are you surprised at the fiery ordeal among you as if something strange were happening to you? Peter asks his audience. I think this is in chapter 2. But anyway, in chapter 4, it says, for those who suffer according to the will of God, entrust yourselves to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. And so in this exhortation from Peter, we have an attitude instruction and we have a behavior instruction. Our attitude is, no matter what happens, we are entrusting ourselves to our faithful Creator. And our action guide is that we do what's right. We don't begin compromising on what's right because things are hard. We do what's right, even if other people aren't doing what's right. And that's our formula. We entrust ourselves to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. And one last thing that I'll tell you that I remind myself of that makes a huge difference for me is I remind myself that these years that we have on this earth in this life are not the only years we have. I have years upon years upon years upon years ad infinitum into the future left to enjoy life in its fullest. And if there are things in this life that get in the way of me getting what I want and enjoying life in the fullest in this life, that's okay. This is temporary, maybe is another way of putting it. This is just temporary, okay? So I don't know. Are you married, Paul?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So think about you have children?
Yeah, I've got a son, 18.
Okay, they're 18. So that temporary period of having kids in the house and all the responsibility, that's almost over. So, I mean, I have a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old too. And so those things can get hard. Now, one could think this way. I don't really think about this because I don't want my girls to leave. You know, they're just too young, it seems to me. I don't think about letting them go yet. But the point I'm making is there are hard times we have, but we can see that sometime in the future, the circumstance is going to change, and then this hard situation will also change. And so we are hopeful in the moment because we know it's going to be different in the future. And this is precisely what I'm saying here now. We are hopeful in the moment, and the moment here being this life, because it's going to be different in the future. And this is why Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, one of my most favorite passages, he says that, you know, we do not lose heart, because even though, you know, this tent is withering away, you know, on the outside, external circumstances, inside we are being built up, okay? And then he says, for a momentary light affliction, which is an odd thing for him to say, because in human terms, it was not momentary,
much
his affliction.
Worse than all of us, yeah.
Yeah, and it wasn't light. But he was looking at a different perspective. He said, this affliction is producing for us, note the verb, it's doing the work. It's producing for us an eternal weight of glory. So that's the future we have of hope. And I like this world to a great degree. I enjoy my life. And it isn't like I can't wait to die and go be with God. You know, that'll be fine when it happens. But until then, I've got meaningful work I can do and valuable things I can pursue. But I know that this time is preparatory for later. So I would tell your people, Are you a pastor, Paul?
Yes, I'm a pastor.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I would tell him first. We have to first look and see, what are we upset about? Are we upset that we lost, or are we upset because of the loss that comes to our community because of this foolish road they're going down? That's the first thing. Secondly, yes, this is a loss, but the community has been going down this road even before same-sex marriage for a long, long time. And we can't expect non-Christians to live like Christians, okay? What we can expect is Christians to live like Christians in the midst of it. And if things get harder for us, then we entrust ourselves to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. And it's easier to do that when we remind ourselves that this life is temporary. It isn't all there is. It's going to get better, okay? And this helps us endure the temporary hardships that we endure, because we realize that there is something better down the line. God is going to fix it, and we are going to be part of that fix. We are going to enjoy it. And this 410, this 80-some years that we live on this planet is a very, very small period of time compared to eternity. And that's the way the Bible tells us to look at it, and that's the way I try to look at it. So that's what I pass on to you.
Mm-hmm. Very good,
what do you
Greg.
Think, Paul?
Thank you very much. Excellent.
Well,
excellent.
You're very welcome, and thank you for your patience waiting so long on the line. And I hope that whatever I've offered you will be an encouragement to your local community of Christians there. Okay.
Right. And if you get tired of fishing in Wisconsin, you can come to Costa Rica and we'll have a couple.
Oh, I understand. It's magnificent down there. I have a friend that I think goes down there to surf, and it's a beautiful country. So anyway, que Dios te bendiga, señor.
Amen.
And God bless you.
All right. Amen.
Okay,
right.
And love to hear from you again.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye now. All right, time for a break. We'll come back with more reflection and callers here on Stand to Reason in just a moment.
We have some really exciting news. We have a new name for our student apologetics conferences. At Stand to Reason, we talk a lot about reality. As a result, we're in the habit of saying Christianity is the best explanation of the way things are. That is, Christianity matches up with the way the world really is, with reality. It makes sense of the origin and design of the universe and life, the existence of objective truth and morality, the purpose, meaning, and value of human experience, the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, and the existential longing of every human heart. In other words, we have reality on our side. That's why we've decided to call our events, drumroll please, STR's Reality Conference. Unfortunately, many students are under the impression that Christianity is make-believe for grown-ups. At our apologetic student conferences, we're pushing back by using our greatest ally, reality. Christianity isn't a made-up story divorced from reality. It is the true story of reality. So join us at one of our two-day reality conferences in California, Washington, Minnesota, or Texas. Discover why we believe Christianity is the best explanation of the way things are by visiting realityapologetics.com and registering today.
You know, if you've gained anything from listening to Stand to Reason, I'd really be thrilled to hear it from you. I love to take your questions, of course, but I also want your feedback. So here's what you can do. Head over to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating and a review. That kind of thing really helps us to get the word out so more ambassadors for Christ can find the show and become equipped to stand confidently. And you never know, I might just give you a shout out on the air to show you my appreciation for your positive review. I value you as a faithful listener. I look forward to reading what you think about the show. Thanks. Show a Stand to Reason, Greg Coakley, your host. And as usual, giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Tuesday night, pretty much, from 6. No, make that from 4 until 6. Tuesday evenings, Los Angeles time. If you're interested in connecting with me, as others have done today, our number is 855-243-9975. And if you're calling international, like Paul did. Yeah, Paul did just a moment ago. 562-424-8229 is our number. I'm actually going to go right now to Jordan in Georgia because I was planning to do some talking, but he's been waiting for an hour and 21 minutes. Jordan, you are one faithful bird. I'll tell you that. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Greg.
Sure. Hey, I got a question to ask you, though, because we were wondering ourselves. We held you over from last hour, which means in the 3 minutes between when we finished taping for one and tape the other, our mics are open and we're talking to each other. But we were curious if the callers who are on hold could actually hear our conversation during that time. Could you hear us talking?
Yes, I could hear some talking, yes. I couldn't really pick up most of the words, but I could definitely hear some voices here or there, yes.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good for us to know. I'm glad you told me that. We're generally fairly careful, obviously, but still. Actually, it's interesting, in my comment, in light of the question you have. So why don't you go ahead and ask your question, and we'll chat about it a little bit.
Okay. Yeah. So basically, my question, I've actually asked it on STR Ask a few times on Twitter, but it's Amy actually said that you did answer it, but something happened and it didn't go through or something like that. But essentially, it's just kind of deals with just sort of language and how it's very cultural and contextual thing. So if someone uses something that would be considered crass or maybe a cuss word or a swear word, but if it's not used in a demeaning way, is it wrong to do so?
Uh-huh. Well, you know, before I became a Christian, I moved to California, and I was raised in a home where children were taught not to speak in a disrespectful or vulgar fashion, which would include all of the language that you are generally describing there. However, the parents didn't have to follow that rule, okay? And when I got to California, I was amazed at how many people said, "This is really bitchin'," because I was taught that that's not a word you use in that way and in polite conversation, right? And even saying it just then, reporting what people say in California used to say, especially surfer crowds, and it was not considered inappropriate at all. It's a way of saying that was really cool. You know, even mentioning it there, it kind of makes me feel a little bit awkward because of the way that I was raised. And so what you have raised is a question that does have to do in some measure, I think, with – well, the way you put it is considered. What is considered coarse or vulgar or inappropriate or something like that? And I do think that there is a cultural element here. Now, I have no trouble with saying darn or dang or dad blasted or whatever. Now, there are many Christians that think that that's just flat out wrong. And the reason is that those words are standing in for other more coarse words or more disreputable words like damn, for example, that or the GD word, you know, gosh darn is GD, but it's other letters. And so we know what you're really saying. And so those are words that people would not be comfortable with. In fact, you know, the OMG, whenever I write OMG, I always do OM, capital G-O-S-H. Oh my gosh, because I don't want some Christian to think I'm saying, oh my God, in that sense with that acronym and have them be offended. Now, okay, so all this to say is there is a subjective element in this. Okay. Now, the scripture has a very specific directive about these things, and I'm not sure. I think it's in Philippians, but it goes something like this. Let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth except such a word that is good for edification according to the need of the moment that it may give grace to those who hear. Well, that's a good guideline. But people say, well, there you go. There's pretty clear. No nasties. No. Okay, but there's a question here. the text says no unwholesome word, and in order that it may give grace to those who hear. And so the concept of what is unwholesome in some circumstances is different than what is unwholesome in other circumstances. And from what I can tell, that word I described earlier that scandalized me when I first came to California might have been an example of that. Okay. Now, there might be some people that disagree, but I'm just saying there was a cultural difference there. And so I think that the propriety of language depends entirely on, you know, on the environment that you're in. If I'm with a bunch of guys, you know, and I'm in the woods and I'm going to go to the bathroom, I'm not likely to say I'm going to go see a man about a horse, you know, although I might say that in mixed company. I wouldn't say it to a bunch of guys. I'd use something that was a little more earthy. But it would not be considered in that environment inappropriate. It's just that's we're it's got just a bunch of guys here, you know. Now, I don't think that flexibility is limitless. You know, I do think that there are boundaries to that. I'm just pointing to the fact that there does seem to be a flexibility here, even from the text, this idea of what is a wholesome word or what is a vulgar word or what is coarse jesting, that may vary in different circumstances. And so what kind of joking around that might be completely acceptable with a bunch of guys, in a that are in a ice house ice fishing, you know, in the dead of winter, but will not be acceptable at dinner time with mixed company, you know. And I'm not even talking about using really nasty words. I'm just talking about general conversation. We just soften up a little bit, you know, to be more polite. So I'm not even here making reference to what most people would consider swear words, and I'm not saying their swear words are okay in one environment, not another. I'm just talking right now that just normal conversation, you're going to be more careful in some circumstances than in others because there is a politeness that's involved, and we're taking into account the exhortation to choose words that are according to the need of the moment, so that could give grace to those who hear. So all I've done so far is just set up the general principle that circumstances matter to the application of this rule, okay? And your question was, is it wrong to use an expletive? And it's not clear to me what the expletive, what qualifies as an expletive here yet, but
right,
if it's not—
That's kind of where I was it seemed kind of arbitrary because anyone could say any word is an expletive according to them. It seems very subjective and arbitrary to just kind of pick a word and say, oh, I don't like that word. And, you know, I'm a very, most language doesn't offend me. I don't really care how someone speaks. I'm not the language police. If you want to say something, go ahead. You know, that's just how I am. But I'm also very, very considerate of other people. I'm not going to use language that's going to offend them. And I'm going to use language in a situation that's appropriate for that situation.
Sure. And by the way, I know that you don't know the answer to this because every guy does. What is the way that guys usually show affection for each other? This is not a hard one. Don't think physical affection. What is the way that guys show affection for each other? Oh, you know
I'm
this.
I'm not sure, Greg. I might not.
Yes, you do. Guys make fun of each other. They put each other down. They call each other names. I was just talking to Frank Turk earlier. I said, hear your voice, but I got to look at your ugly face, Frank. You know, because I'm on the screen here. Okay. Okay, so what? Am I calling him ugly and I'm being mean? No, I'm telling him I like him. He's my friend.
Right.
I mean, so you know what I'm talking about now, right? Guys show affection for each other if we're friends with each other, by putting each other down. Hey, funny looking. Did you hear what I said? Okay. All right. Man, how did a beautiful woman like your wife get married to an ugly guy like you? How did that happen?
Right.
Your kids, fortunately, look better than your wife than they do like you. We say this kind of stuff, okay? Mm-hmm. So the point I'm making here is there are ways that we would express ourselves in that circumstance with other guys to show them affection that we would never use to show affection to our wives or our children, right? Because it's a different setting and a different set of circumstances, okay? Now, I also think that in light of the directive that I cited earlier, I think from Philippians, that the it matters whether you're alone or not, okay? Now, I'm not saying that when you're alone, it's a free-for-all verbally. I'm just saying it matters. And I'm much more careful about saying what I say when others are around, particularly children and women, et cetera, or people I don't know or whatever, than when I'm with my guy friends, you know. And if I bang my knee on something, I might, I'll ow or whatever. But, I would express frustration maybe a little bit more in a different way in those safer environments, or if I was all by myself. Okay, because I do think that the concern here is largely how it sounds to other people, to give grace to those who hear. Okay, and so if there's nobody here and it's just me, then if I do a dag nabbit or whatever, I'm not going to get too bent out of shape about it. Now sometimes I do. It troubles me if I speak, in a sense, out of turn, even when I'm alone, and then I just say, "I'm sorry, Lord. I went over the top," or however. So I'm not really, to be honest with you, and I'm totally candid, I guess is what I mean, is like I don't make a big deal about it except for in public. And in that situation, I hear things, F-bombs, for example, on TV, well, not TV, but movies, and I can't figure out why the heck they had to include that in there. There's no need for that. It's just ridiculous. I have some of my own opinions about why that's in films and stuff like that, but it's just kind of a way of going out of their way of being iconoclastic and breaking the mold and I don't have to follow your rules kind of idea when that's like in your face, and that stuff bothers me. So I do think there is language that's over the top in a circumstance like that. But I don't fuss about the smaller stuff, especially if it's in private, and I don't pick at other people about it, even Christians, unless it's really inappropriate for the circumstance. Now, I had to correct my daughter the other day, and she didn't say no swear word. I mean, she's scandalized by that kind of stuff. But she did use some vocabulary that was a little bit coarse for the circumstances. And I called her back and said, "Honey, I don't want you talking like that. It's vulgar. I want you to talk like a young lady, okay?" And so, okay, we had our instructive moment. It was over. So I do think those kinds of things are important. But I don't have a hard and fast rule for everything. And some people may, and more power to them, But I just, right, for myself, I think I'm more flexible in that regard, more charitable to myself and maybe to others, and that might be you as well. And I do think that even the biblical record talking about these things identifies that the circumstances are relevant to the propriety of the language.
Yeah, I would wholeheartedly agree. I've language is something that I've always been interested in, and this particular topic has always kind of just perplexed me because it always seems sort of outlandish or arbitrary, just kind of because it doesn't describe what words are good or bad. It just says unwholesome speech or coarse language and stuff. So I just never had a firm grasp of what it was talking about. And I'm very, when I'm in public or at work or anything like that, I'm always very, very careful with what I say and how I say it, or, talking like this in a professional setting. But with guy friends or something like that, it's a little bit looser and stuff like that. So, but I do appreciate you sort of giving me some insight there.
Yeah, and there are people who are going to disagree with me on this. I mean, some people are in the military. Look, at that is a whole other story, especially if you're in combat. Okay, I was in the military from 1968 to 74, and I wasn't a Christian at the time, and I wasn't in combat. But man, that was a whole different environment there, and I sometimes wonder, what would I be like if I was back in that environment? Because there's a whole different kind of vocabulary. I think I would be much more tame than I was then, obviously, but I do think that the environment that is described there is a little bit different kind of environment, and that is a factor here. Now, I could be wrong on this kind of stuff, and some people are shaking their heads saying, "Oh man, Coco's lost his mind," whatever. I think these are judgment calls, and this is one fortunate thing. It is fortunate, I should say, that the grace of God applies here as well. And I don't mean we can just be free to sin, because of the grace of God. I mean, we can be free to make to be mistaken in our assessments. We have safety when we come to assess these things and make our best judgments in the circumstance. And sometimes we don't even keep by our standards, but the grace of God still avails for us. And if it didn't, we'd all be in really big trouble.
Absolutely.
All righty.
Sounds good. Did want to mention that when I was on the line, I was listening to the previous show, and you were talking about bloom where you're planted. Well, a funny story. This past Sunday, I'm blooming where I'm planted. I was actually teaching some apologetics to some members of my church on Zoom video. I went through the Columbo tactic and the suicide tactic with them, and then also the moral argument for the existence of God. It was a pretty good session. It was me and a couple other guy friends, so it was a really good time.
Well, you must have been right in your groove when I had that discussion last hour about the moral argument. Were you on then?
Yeah, I was listening to that.
Yeah. Okay, super. Hey, I am proud of you, Jordan. Good for you. And you know that when you do that, you're not just helping other people. You are helping yourself in a certain sense, because the more you teach it, the better you learn it, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Repetition is the mother of all skill.
That's right. There you go. All right, Jordan. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Talk to you later, Greg.
All right. Bye-bye now. Let's go to break here. Then I have some things to say that may help you all think of the significance of your actions here during this difficult time we're in right now. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Some people treat Christianity like it's a build-your-own Sunday shop. They include the bits they like and exclude the bits they don't. The problem is, truth is not ice cream. You can't build your own biblical reality like you build an ice cream sundae. You can't pick and choose the parts you prefer. Truth doesn't work like that. Truth is what matches up with reality. Sadly, there are some who are creating a version of Christianity that fits their own subjective desire rather than sound doctrine. At this year's STR Reality Conferences, you will get the tools to identify counterfeit versions of Christianity so you can guard against them. We want to show you that biblical reality isn't something we shape, rather, it's something that shapes us. So join us at one of this year's STR Reality Conferences. Discover why truth is not ice cream by visiting realityapologetics.com and registering today.
Did you know Stand to Reason has a YouTube channel? We release a new video each Monday on the topics you care about. Through short, engaging videos, our speakers train you on tactics, offer apologetics tips, answer common theology questions, and address big issues in the world today. Join tens of thousands of other subscribers so you can stay up to date when we release a new video. Just go to youtube.com and search STR videos, all one word, and hit the subscribe button. That's STR videos. Take advantage of this free resource to help you stay informed, encouraged, and equipped as you share your worldview with others.
All right, final segment here on the show. This is unusual because I'm closing with a commentary rather than opening with one. But I wanted to get to those dear callers who had been waiting for so long, especially one from Central America. Is Costa Rica in Central America? I got to look at my map. And so now I want to talk to you about something. It's actually something I wrote about, January 2012. I'm looking at the date of the solid ground that I wrote that conveys this information. That's over 8 years ago. My goodness. I was 62 years old at the time, a young spring chicken. And I talked about a concept that had occurred to me as a result of a conversation amongst some other Christian leader friends of mine, and how it got me thinking about a certain dynamic that I saw in the body of Christ in general, in our community, and the impact or the significance that had for people in our Stand to Reason community, our broader community, and these pieces for me began to fall into place. Actually, it was the summer of 2011, and it was in the small town of Turlock, California. It's Central Valley. And I was having dinner there with colleagues before an event. And seated around the table, all right, Craig Hazen, Dr. Frank Beckwith, I co-authored a book with him, William Lane Craig, J.P. Moreland, and me. And so we were getting ready to do this event, but we were all having dinner together. And all of us, of course, are deeply involved in publicly defending the faith and have been on a national level for years. Now, as we conversed, though, we began to reflect on the people that had made a difference for us when we were all kind of wet behind the ears pups during the Jesus movement or soon after that. And the list was actually short because for us, when we were new Christians, this would be roughly the early 70s, there were not that many in play. That is, that there were not that many who were actively, professionally writing and speaking on apologetics, okay? And we ticked them off, the people that had had a deep influence on our life early on. And Norm Geisler was right there at the top of the list. Of course, he was still alive at the time. We lost him earlier this year. John Warwick Montgomery, who is still alive now. Francis Schaeffer, we lost him in the 80s. Josh McDowell, still with us and working hard. And Walter Martin, who we also lost in the 80s. That was it, five people. Geisler, Montgomery, Schaeffer, McDowell, and Martin. Not count Lewis, because Lewis was a player, obviously, but a prior generation. And he had had an influence on most of us, I guess, at one time or another, and still is. But these were the people upon whose shoulders we stood intellectually. And JP was kind of setting the tone in this conversation. He was expressing his gratitude for those who pioneered in our field and laid the foundation for our work. And his point was actually really simple. He said, we are in their debt. We owe them. So let's stay faithful. Let's stay united. Let's leave a legacy behind in the lives of others, just as those other men had done in our lives. Let's end well. I mean, it was quintessential J.P. Moreland in a private setting. Press on further, stay tough, follow hard after the Lord, finish the course. Great stuff. And as I looked back after that conversation, I began reflecting about those first five men that were, in a certain sense, our mentors, and that they were, one could say, the first column in the fight, in a sense. They were paving the way. They were setting the example. They were establishing a kind of a beachhead. And by the way, the fact that we were looking back then on those men showed that they had already left behind a legacy. We were that legacy. Many of them, half of them at the time, were still in play, but we were their legacy. And so there was fruit that they had borne that was bearing more fruit. That first fruit us remained, and we were bearing more fruit. Okay, they were the ones who taught us. They set the standard for us to shoot for, and maybe even exceed. Then they inspired us to imagine a day when thoughtful Christians would once again be active players in the marketplace of ideas, and it was about time. And for some of you who are relatively new, within the last 10 or 15, maybe even 20 years, you're not quite aware of what it was like before. And what it was like before is that things were pretty bleak in the intellectual world for Christians. Back in the earlier part of the century, would have been the 20th century, state legislators started passing laws against teaching evolution, so they were conservative and religiously directed, but that was pushed back with the ACLU, and you had the monkey trials, and you had a whole bunch of things happening that ended up isolating Christians, okay? And we circled the wagons, basically, and chose kind of a cultural monasticism rather than hard-hitting advocacy, and we left the public square to the secularists. And for most of the 20th century, it was disciples of Dewey and Marx and Darwin and Freud and Nietzsche and B.F. Skinner and a host of others that replaced the disciples of Jesus in the cultural conversation. So the irony is that we, that is Christians, in this case Puritan Christians early on, had been the founding fathers of the intellectual community in the United States. But for a long time, most – the bulk of the – certainly the middle of the 20th century, Christians had not been outthought. But as Oz Guinness pointed out, they just weren't around when the thinking was being done. And so we got supplanted and our ideas got supplanted. And what happened was a secular culture resulted, all right? And slowly things began to change, and they started to change in the late 60s, early 70s, initiated by these five men that I mentioned, but then also by sharp and fair-minded people who were following in their footsteps. Okay, and I mentioned Oz Guinness. He was one example, a disciple of Francis Schaeffer at La Brie. There was what was going on, a second column beginning to form. The first column, those five. The second column, those who learned from those five. And this is my own terminology, but it's just a way of me keeping track of it all. Those who learned from those five, which included those seated around that table. And we all had our own individual stories of what God had done in us and through us since the early days. And it was clear to me that what God had been doing amounted to more than the sum of our individual contributions. Something else was going on. There's a synergy that was going on. The Holy Spirit was doing something. And for, at that time, now close to 20 years, this is 13 years ago, but at that time about 20 years, a second column had been forming, and the second column was much bigger than the first. The first column were the pioneers. The second were the leaders who were influenced, either directly or indirectly, by that first band. Includes Rabbi Zacharias, was part of that early crowd and now leader of organizations, people now heading up enterprises of their own. And now they have much larger impact than our mentors could have ever accomplished on their own. And that's the simple calculus of discipleship and multiplication. And we were reflecting at that dinner, and I have reflected since then, that we, in what I've come to call the second column, we saw the need to equip the rank-and-file Christians to defend classical Christianity and classical Christian values with people who didn't understand our language and who didn't accept our source of authority. How are we going to build an army of clear-thinking Christians that can go out into that culture and can make a difference? That was what our concern was, and my concern in starting Stand to Reason and developing it up until that time. And we were convinced that, of course, Christianity could compete in the marketplace of ideas if it was properly understood, if it was properly articulated and defended. We were committed to a diplomatic model of fair-minded advocacy to make the point that Christianity was still worth thinking about. That's what we call Stand to Reason, Christianity worth thinking about. But I realized that the second column was small. I mean, people like, I mentioned Ravi, I mentioned Oz, Nancy Piercy, Chuck Colson, David Noble at Summit Ministries, Gary Habermas, Stephen Meyer, Bill Dembski, Lee Strobel, Hugh Ross, just to name a few. There's a whole lot of them. But even those members of the second column whose names are on books and you see on marquees of events and maybe running organizations, that second column, big compared to the first, is small compared to the one that follows. And I call this the third column. And the third column has been forming for a while. I see it everywhere. Everywhere I travel, I meet sharp and committed ambassadors for Christ who are students of the people in those first two columns. And what they are doing, watch this, they are grouping up with others of kindred spirit in their local communities. And you see, this is where this reflection is so important during a time like this. Because now we're kind of atomized, right? We're not meeting in big meetings. We're not, you know, having big conferences. They're not allowing us to do that. And who knows how long it's going to be until that happens. It can go two different directions. All right. I'm not going to get into the details, but I have no confidence in which particular direction this whole thing is going to play itself out over time. But the point is that we have been, in a certain sense, atomized into smaller groups. But that's precisely what the third column it is. It's other groups of Christians committed to thoughtful Christianity, having a kindred spirit, and they're operating in their local communities. And for those in the third column, your names, that's what I'm talking to you. Your names will probably never grace the cover of a book. They won't be in lights on an apologetics conference marquee. Instead, you are the foot soldiers with your boots on the ground individually being faithful to defend the gospel in all of these smaller arenas that the commander-in-chief has entrusted to you. They're not places I'm going to go. Not places that Oz Guinness is going to go, or Lee Strobel, or Gary Habermas, or Robbie Zacharias. It's the place where you're going to go. It's the people you personally have access to. This is a concept that Edmund Burke called little platoons, small bands of ordinary people making a difference right where they live. Not large organizations, not huge institutions, but collectively, these platoons scattered around the country and more around the world are growing into an army of clear-thinking Christians. And this is what I had and have envisioned for Stand to Reason from its outset. And I've always given kind of two different pieces of advice for those of you in that circumstance. And the first one is to gather. I'm just going to call it gather scatter because I want you to get together, gather together in your little platoons, kindred spirit people, gather and gather information. In other words, be a student of your craft. Learn in your local church, in your local social circles, in your school, in your work, wherever it happens to be. Find the dry tinder, kindred spirit folk, and then start a larger fire using that drier tinder, okay? And when you meet, ask questions, raise issues, entertain the challenges, the hard ones, the ones the skeptics have raised, the ones that have vexed you personally, and work out a voice on these things, okay? And then use that voice wherever you are. And this is the second step, is that is what we talked about earlier, blooming where you're planted. You're scattering into your larger community. You're gathering, then you're scattering. You gather together, the church comes out of the marketplace, the called out ones, the ecclesia, and then you are equipped and go back out and bloom where you're planted. And this is a principle that has served me well my entire Christian life. It will be your servant as well. Bloom where you're planted. That is, make the best of the opportunities within your immediate grasp, even if they seem small or inconsequential. Okay? The first time I taught the Bible was with people I led to the Lord in the early parts of the Jesus movement. We were sitting on a floor, four of us, going over texts. Did I know much? No. But I knew more than they did, so I passed it on. Okay? So if you can't speak to 100, speak to 10. If you can't speak to 10, then speak to one. Maybe a solitary soul at Starbucks. When you can't speak, write. If you have a blog, go ahead. Use that. Or someone else's. Or write a letter to the editor. Do people still do that anymore? I don't know. Write in your diary. Write personal reflections. Write things down. Don't lose them. Put them in a file. Someday they'll find their way into something that others might read. Don't let your seeds of insight slip away, is what I'm saying. Find the soil, some soil, for them to take root in. And when possible, do both, talk and write if you're able. Keep your eyes open and take the opportunities that come your way and do whatever you can, wherever you are, even if it's modest, even if it's unexceptional, it's all right. Because you will be amazed as you watch to see how the Lord decides to use what you offer him. And sometimes it's the smallest of seeds that grow into the largest of trees. That was what Jesus said, right? Mustard seed. And that's how the third column works. And this notion of blooming where you're planted meshes seamlessly with the basic biblical principle, by the way. First, you have to be faithful in smaller things before you can be entrusted with larger ones. And if bigger things never come your way, that's all right. The small acts of faithfulness will be enough. God is honored in every act of fidelity, grand or simple. No worries. First column was tiny. The second column was bigger, much, much bigger than the first column. And the third column is massive. And you are part of it. Every one of you that are listening to me, you are part of it. And we are facing a circumstance now where you are spread out in communities can have an impact that people like me can't have. You are the third column. And J.P. Moreland's advice to each of us around that table that night in Turlock is the same advice that I pass on to you. We are in debt to those who came before us. Let's stay faithful. Let's stay united. We gather, we scatter, we bloom. Make a difference even if it's small. Leave a legacy behind in the life of others, just as those men have done in. I'm thankful for those men. And some of them still around and continue to have an influence on me. And I hope that I continue to have an influence on you. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye now.